You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the top news stories of 2015, Host Edition. This week, we talk about my picks for the top news stories of 2015, ISIS and the federal election of 2015. Let's begin episode 324.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and, of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Last couple of weeks, we talked about the top science stories of 2015. This week, we're going to talk about the top news stories of the year. Basically, anything but science. Returning this week is Gulid. Say hello, Gulid.
Hello, folks. Glad to be with you.
And Nicholas has joined us yet again. Say hi, Nicholas.
Hey, guys. It's my pleasure to be on the show again.
And joining us is Matt. Say hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Okay, it's my show, so let me start again. So on my list this week, the top three news stories of the year is ISIS. Well, this has sort of been the year of ISIS. Now, there's lots of stuff that has come up with it. One is how ISIS has been able to manipulate social media to do both recruiting, but also as a means to inflict terror on people. I don't want anyone to go onto YouTube or anything to Google ISIS, but trust me, they have a lot of social media out there, and it's pretty horrific in what it's doing. We've also noticed this year that there's been a dramatic expansion of groups, either directly or indirectly, pledging allegiance to ISIS. You've got groups in Libya, Yemen, Egypt, Indonesia, Algeria, the Northern Caucasus, and beyond. Even famously Boko Haram, which is based in Nigeria, which was a big thing all unto itself, has also pledged allegiance. And this leads to a very interesting discussion. I mean, ISIS itself is the Islamic State, or at least it purports to do that. But is it really an Islamic State, or is it more just a terrorist group?
I would probably label them more as a terrorist group, in my opinion. I think one of the tactics they'd want is, or one of the tactics they would use is for us to believe that they're, you know, an organized state, when most likely, in my opinion, they're just a terrorist group.
We'll find out that there are threads in a lot of our choices that lead into other stuff. But focusing just on ISIS in the Levant, which is basically Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, that sort of area. In that area, I mean, they do have a lot of facets of a state. They collect taxes. They have schools. One of the interesting things that has come out, too, is that they make a lot of money by selling oil to, well, ostensibly their neighbors. Russia recently accused Turkey of doing that. And Matt, do you think that that ISIS qualifies as a state?
I mean, the lines are blurred here. They are absolutely a group. They are absolutely a terror group. But, I mean, it depends on what you qualify as a state. Right now, I've been listening to the second season of the Serial podcast. And in it, the host was interviewing a reporter who was captured by a group in Afghanistan, I mean, a couple of years ago, but he noticed, you know, a somewhat of a community, even being, you know, transferred by these groups of men with AK-47. So the blurred line, it's more of a terrorist state than anything else. I mean, it's hard to define the boundaries there.
Nicholas, what do you think? Again, just trying to deal with the area itself. From your perspective, what impact do you think ISIS has had on how we deal with the whole Middle East area?
I think ISIS, what they're trying to do is to become ultimately a state can host whatever they believe in. So by using terrorism as one of the ways they can achieve that goal, they, at this point in time, I believe they are terrorists, but in the long term, once they achieve the goal, eventually they will become a proper state if the goal becomes true.
So one of the differences I see between ISIS and some of the other states that we don't have any problem calling them states isn't in its use of sort of terror tactics, at least on its own people, as we would define ISIS as doing. If you take a look at countries like North Korea, the things North Korea does to its people, I think, would qualify as a form of terrorism. I mean, at least in a very broad sense of that word. And countries like Eritrea. Eritrea is known as one of the most abusive nations to its own people on the planet. And yet we don't mind calling those countries, even if we disagree with how they treat their people. Whereas ISIS seems to be the biggest thing preventing us from calling it a state. And all of you guys have basically said, no, it's not really a state. Isn't that it doesn't have the trappings of a state or even how it treats its people, but because it's an upstart, it is new. And actually, it's that newness that is its biggest handicap as far as being treated as a true state.
I think you're right in terms of it being such a new, quote-unquote, movement. That absolutely adds to it. And I think the other part of it is how aggressive they are towards the outside world. I mean, North Korea, as you were mentioning, it's internal and, of course, you know, has been there for so long. But the places you mentioned, and as you mentioned, are internal fighting, internal horrors, whereas ISIS has been externalizing this anger. And I think that's where they are getting a lot of their supporters from. I think it's releasing this anger upon the other people who have it better than them, and they're turning it on to that. So that, A, yes, it is new, but B, because they are so external, people don't want to take it, and people condemn them for it.
I think one of the interesting things, too, about it is I mentioned one of the things that's made this sort of unique in many ways is its use of social media. And I was listening to a documentary recently that had mentioned that some of the videos that ISIS is coming out with are like hundreds of thousands of dollars as far as production costs go. And this for sort of a YouTube terrorist video seems like a lot of money. Like they're taking this extremely seriously. And I do think the fact that they are kind of rubbing the world's nose in what they're doing, whereas in North Korea or in Eritrea, I mean, to their own people, they're horrific, but they don't really want the whole world to know it. What do you think about that, Gulen?
I think that's definitely a good point. We do live in the social media age, and what we see does have a lasting impression on us. With North Korea being more, I don't want to say secretive, but, you know, just not showing what they're doing to their civilians as much. We're sort of more, you know, complacent with what's going on there. Whereas with ISIL and what they're doing to civilians, posting it on social media, we can see it, we can react to it, and it'll really give us an impression of what to think.
And Nicholas, what do you think of the whole idea that ISIS has become this sort of boogeyman to the globe? I was reading one other, it was a famous thing, and I included it in one of my shows, an Australian company that basically says one of ISIS's tactics for success is to basically say, we did it, whatever it is, if it was bad, we did it. And they just take claim for everything, whether they actually had anything involved in it or not. It basically raises their profile, and most media is pretty simplistic. And if it can say, oh, ISIS did it, good, let's put that stamp on it, and we've got our catchphrase for the 6 o'clock news.
I think at this stage, if ISIS wants to be a proper state for a long run, they need to there's a lot of struggle going on with the outside world. That's why I think that's one reason why ISIS claimed those kind of attacks, just because they want to raise awareness, let the world know who they are, what they can do, and eventually they'll try to become a legit state that is recognized by different nations.
Now, one of the things that has recently come out, if I remember correctly, and I may be misremembering this, but one of the Republican wannabe presidents is Ted Cruz, came out and said that we should just carpet bomb the entire ISIS, quote, state. And normally I would sit back and I would say that's poppycock, crazy talk, they're nuts. But there is one thing ISIS is doing that I must admit is definitely twisting my whatever. And that is its destruction of historical landmarks. I mean, last year alone, they destroyed a 12th century Kurdish mosque, a 7th century Al-Tahar church, the Syrian gateway lion sculptures that date back to the 8th century BC, the Nineveh wall, which is like 700 BC, the Nimrod, the Assyrian city, basically from the 13th century, has been more or less blown away. Lots, the Temple of Bel, which was dedicated in 32 AD, blown up. And to me, these things are like crimes against humanity. I mean, you know, okay, killing people is not necessarily a good thing, but there are lots of people in the world and most people can be more or less replaced. Sorry, that sounds really cruel, but these things, I mean, these are irreplaceable. And this doesn't belong to any one person. This belongs to humanity itself. And I mean, they're destroying them just to get people like me to overreact, which, trust me, I would really like to overreact. But at the same time, this just strikes me as just a whole new level of evil. What do you guys think?
I think it's completely barbaric. You know, these are monuments, shrines. These are, you know, structures that mean a lot to the nations and the regions and to the people that live there. And, you know, I feel like they're just exploiting the significance of these monuments just to piss people off. And it's ridiculous.
Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, actually, yeah. I would relate it to the destruction of, you know, the library in Alexandria or the atrocities done by the Nazis as well. I think, again, they provoke. It's what they do. And destroying history, destroying what came before us is horrible. I think there are those of us like myself and like Don and probably you guys as well and many of you listeners that find that to be such a horrible thing. I think others won't mind as much, but for those of us who want to preserve what got us here, being angry about that is the right action. And again, that's what ISIS thrives on, is anger and fear. I want to go a little bit further back when you were saying, Don, about, you know, ISIS did it, and that's what they claim. They did that with Jakarta as well, with the recent attack in Jakarta. They say that ISIS did it, but I was reading an article that said, you know, the gunmen were very inexperienced, so we don't know for sure, but it's the same kind of concept as making sure that they can get all the hatred they can get.
Yeah, I definitely feel that what they're doing is not right. But I think I can kind of understand why they're doing this. They want to destroy all the landmarks. They want to get all the attention they can get in order to really show off to the world to see what they can do and then make sure no one will mess with them. I think that's the one reason why they want to claim all the terrorist attacks around the globe. It's because they want people to be feared by ISIS. And it's like, you know, the naughty kid in class tried to get the teacher's attention and also get the classmates' attention to make sure no one else will mess with them. I think that's one of their strategy to, you know, achieve the goal.
I just to add to that, I think personally, I think it might backfire on them if you think that might be their strategy. It'll backfire on them eventually, because someday they're going to piss off the biggest kid in school and it'll be their ruin. Such as the United States.
Well, okay. So that's very interesting thread to pull at, because I mean the United States is already basically bombing the crap out of them, along with France and Russia and Syria. I mean, even Canada is doing its pathetic, but, you know, it's a little bit.
It's holding the hand and saying, yeah, we're in too.
Exactly. And that seems to have done nothing but bolster it. I mean, I talked before about its social media and how it's using that to recruit people to come and join them. And although for every story you hear about someone going over joining, there's like two that say, oh yeah, we went there and it was horrible and nobody should go, but they still are getting the recruits. And part of the reason why they can get the recruits is because they can play on this very, how shall I put it, honest narrative that the West is trying to destroy them. And if they can claim to be the true leaders of Islam, which is another claim that they make, that seems to only boost their claims and their power. I mean, just to finish up the thought, I mean, do you think there will be a point where ISIS will be so bad as the Americans will actually put boots on the ground, considering the main reason why ISIS exists today is because of American boots on the ground? Gula, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I actually wanted to bring up that point you made earlier about the media's willingness to put the ISIS stamp on, you know, a lot of the incidents that happen around the world, because that also boosts them as well.
I mean, it also comes down to them themselves, right? It's not just the media that does it. I think they're making a lot of the claims that they are doing. Like, again, bring up Jakarta again, the group actually did say that they carried out the attack. Like, they did say that in an online statement. Who knows? And you know what? People probably did say beforehand, like, oh, it was probably ISIS, and they've probably done it before. But I think that it's a balance of both. It's the media, but it's also themselves.
But Matt, you sort of said that you know, they better be careful. They will raise the big boys will come in.
Yeah.
How do you see that taking place? Like, what exactly do you see?
Well, by attacking people on their home front, such as, you know, in Paris and in Indonesia, like, the more people are going to get involved, especially if you do it on their home ground, on their, you know, in their buildings, in their communities. Once you do that, you're going to get people that are going to come across. I mean, look at what happened when the two towers fell. I mean, it's gonna be the same kind of event if ISIS does end up taking responsibility for any kind of attack on U.S. soil. Like, the things that the U.S. are doing right now, it's gonna be one iota of what they'll do if they do take responsibility for something on, you know, their turf.
So, you know, you bring up a big thing. You bring up 9/11, and 9/11 had a lot to do with this because, I mean, at that time it was Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda was much more of a bring the war to the infidels as opposed to do it at home. And ISIS is definitely pushing the let's do this stuff at home in order to use it as a technique to gain territory. But, I mean, we had Charlie Hebdo, which happened last year, and for those who don't remember, Charlie Hebdo is a, quote, satirical magazine that, how shall we say, stretches the boundaries of good taste. They have a lot of cartoons that pick on Jews in the very stereotypical, almost Nazi kind of stereotyping views. They also take on local politicians, but they were also famous for taking on a lot of Islamic themes and Muhammad themes. And it seems that someone who maybe loosely could be tied with ISIS, actually, I guess it was two of them or three of them, went into the editorial office of the Charlie Hebdo and basically shot everyone that they could get. And lots of people were killed at that. Coincidentally, at the same time, there was another shooter that went to a Jewish supermarket and shot some people. People tend to forget that second one. But it was all part of this sort of terrorist attack in Paris. And that was early last year. And then, of course, later on in the year, we have the more famous Paris bombings and attacks that happened just recently and killed over 100 people. And again, that one was claimed to be ISIS. How much ISIS was involved is a bit debatable. But we had the bombings in Beirut. We've had bombings in Baghdad. Matt has already mentioned that there's been some bombings in Jakarta, among other areas. All of this kind of loosely tied in. We have gun violence with the San Bernardino shooters, who also, again, made claims to ISIS. So there is lots of ISIS-sponsored or at least inspired terrorism going on around the world in a level that seems quite different than that you had from Al-Qaeda. What do you think all this terrorist talk has done?
I mean, ISIS is definitely trying to boost up their profile in the world so that they can get more attention. You know, it is a risky move. But what is interesting is that I remember when ISIS first came to become popular, I guess, many people believe that ISIS wouldn't be a terrorist group just like Al-Qaeda because they focus on their own territory. They try to be independent, create a new Islamic state in the Middle East. So a lot of people believe that is something different. You know, they wouldn't do any terrorist attacks outside the territories. But as we can see, since last year in 2015, there's numerous attacks that were either sponsored or inspired by ISIS. I think they are trying to switch their strategy a little bit, but again, it's a very risky move. All depending on how the rest of the world is going to react to it. I believe many countries start to, fight against ISIS, and then it's interesting how it's going to turn out.
So, Matt, you brought up again the if you wake the sleeping giant type thing in 9/11. I thought there was a certain irony in when President Hollande said that after the second Paris attacks, that this was a declaration of war on France, with sort of forgetting the fact that France had been bombing ISIS for several months prior, almost a year prior, I believe. In which case, I mean, if that wasn't a declaration of war, then I'm not sure what was. So, and there seems to be a correlation with the more that they are attacking ISIS sort of at home, the more ISIS feels the need to bring the war home for those who are attacking them.
Sorry, can you rephrase that a little bit?
I guess basically what I'm trying to say is that, you said, if they push the big guy too much, then the big guy's going to push back. And there has been an escalation of Western attacks and support for people against ISIS in Syria and northern Iraq. And the net result of that is that ISIS has become more active in terrorist attacks on the West because it feels that the pressure at home, and if it can't subjugate its own people, then it basically is taking more time out to attack Paris and who knows where else.
And let's not forget about Beirut. It did happen just beforehand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Here on Radio Free Thinker. Just.
I think that's actually, in terms of Beirut, that's, I actually don't know if Lebanon is involved at all, at least not nearly as much as the United States are, or Paris, or before the attack, I should say, how much they were involved.
Well, Matt, just to fill in, because I'm sure your question is other people's questions, Lebanon has a very interesting relationship, mainly through Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been an ardent supporter of Syria, and conversely, Syria has been an ardent supporter of Hezbollah. And so Hezbollah has been providing a lot of troops and that to Assad in Syria to attack the Free Syrian Army as well as ISIS. And that is sort of the thread as to why Lebanon, in particular Beirut, became the front line of an ISIS terror attack. So again, that leads me back to the question is, in the same way that after 9/11, the Americans came in and they attacked Iraq, boots on the ground, and made a complete pig's breakfast of it, that if they repeat that in order to get rid of ISIS, shouldn't we expect, even if they do defeat ISIS, aren't they just fertilizing the ground for the next form of ISIS? And it seems with each iteration of this sort of cycle, you're getting more extreme and worse groups coming out of it.
More violence begets more violence, right?
Essentially. I mean, one of the sad ironies, and this I get from my studies of psychology, is the people that are leading ISIS, as barbaric and horrific as the things that they are doing, in the context of where they grew up, when they grew up, and the horrific things that they must have been exposed to as children, I mean, it's not far off the base to see why they ended up the way they ended up, right? So again, violence begets violence. Aren't you just perpetuating the cycle?
I would absolutely agree. It's hard because our Western views, our community of countries, we think we are better. And we have this view of what, you know, developed culture should be like. And I don't think many people really know exactly what we've done or how horrible it is over in these areas like Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan and these areas who've been war torn for so many years. I think, honestly, I mean, not to sound horrible, but with enough bombs and violence, I don't think there'll be anything rising out of that. And I don't think it'll come to that.
So, Gulid, first of all, did you have any response to sort of what Matt was saying with his, and Matt, you were very much in the Douglas MacArthur ethos of believing to bomb them back into the Stone Age as being one possible solution. I know you weren't advocating that, but
it's an outcome, not a solution.
Yes. So, Gulid, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think, you know, history does repeat itself. With the with what happened in 9/11, you know, with the all the civilians killed in Iraq as a consequence of that, wasn't a correct consequence in my opinion, but you know that could definitely be a possibility. Then again, you know, with enough military involvement, there could be a potential for wiping out a lot of people in that region. So yeah, I definitely think with the our responses have tend to been very violent, and that doesn't necessarily solve the problem. There's a very high possibility of, you know, another terrorist group coming. So I think we should look towards other solutions.
So I'm gonna pick on you again, Gulid, for two rather I don't want to say tacky because that's not quite the right word, but you'll feel it as a resident Muslim.
Yeah.
There are two questions I have for you. One, are you now or will you ever be a terrorist? Okay, let me add context to that. So as we kind of mentioned before, you know, one of
sorry, Don, that's a bold question. Gulid, as someone who's Muslim, you know, I'm pretty sure at some point we're going to have to put you in a loony bin because you're going to be, you know, a terrorist at some point.
So let me clarify that. We've already talked about the success, I guess, or at least the polished nature of ISIS recruitment videos and that to get people in the West to sort of join them. And we see that one of the biggest things that we hear here at home, more so south of the border than in Canada, but it famously did come up in a previous election, about the whole idea of homegrown terrorists and how we have to be wary of them. And that spirals into a secondary question that because we are in the West to a horrifically grand degree buying into this narrative that Muslims, you never know, any one of them could flip any day and it's a horrible thing. I mean, this in a way isolates the Islamic community in the West, which is exactly the thing ISIS wants to do. It wants to let every Muslim in the world think, you don't belong there. They hate you. They'll always hate you. You'll never be safe. Come home to the Islamic State where you belong. Now, that was a lot of stuff to dump on you. And I apologize for that, Gulid. But what do you make of that narrative? I mean,
You know, I actually couldn't agree more with what you said. You know, the narrative to separate, you know, a lot of the Westerners from, you know, resident Muslims as if they're separate people. You know, if something were to happen, you know, in Vancouver, hopefully not, I would see this as something that's happening against us. I think it's really ignorant to assume that, you know, any regular Muslim would somehow have an allegiance to ISIS. it is almost pushing, you know, everyday Muslims towards recruiting. Not that I think that, you know, that there's somewhat of a correlation there, but I don't think that's the causation. But it definitely does help into what ISIS is trying to do. So I definitely wouldn't want to become a terrorist, but I can definitely see how with a lot of the way the Westerners are responding towards Muslims and seeing them as separate entities in themselves could push them towards terrorist groups like ISIS.
I think one of the things that you get a lot of, more so in Europe than you do here, which is why I think there's more violence. A lot of the people who are coming from the Middle East, North Africa, are seen as migrants and not immigrants. And although the words sound very similar, they're very different in their context, because a migrant is someone who comes and goes, whereas an immigrant becomes incorporated into your society. And I think that's one of the leading dynamics that is fueling this, much more so in Europe, where you get a lot more Islamophobia, at least in the average everyday people. And you do build into that, you make it much more receptive for people who happen to be of Muslim descent and happen to be treated as this migrant community that never will really be part of the nation state. And even if it's only 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 1,000,000, that can be enough for ISIS to succeed in creating quote-unquote homegrown terrorists, even if it's quite disproportionate to the number of Muslims in the country as a whole. Nicholas, I'm curious, from your perspective, what do you take of this whole idea of migrant versus immigrant and how ISIS has used that as a wedge?
In the last couple of weeks, I think there's a group called Anonymous who attacked Donald Trump's website or something like that. Basically, they came up with a message and telling that the more United States appear to be targeting Muslims, ISIS will be putting more on their social media and trying to convince people to or Muslim to join their group. So I think that's many people already realize that. It's just matter of fact how we can find the best solution for this situation, especially right now. ISIS try to push the boundaries further and further. That will eventually leave no choice but to putting soldiers in ISIS.
Boots on the ground, as they would say. In fact, Trump has already been used in at least one, probably a number of quote unquote recruiting videos just to show sort of see how they hate you kind of thing. I think we're going to wrap up the whole ISIS and terrorism thing. And final words on this topic.
Well, it's definitely interesting to see how ISIS has evolved in the last year. And then most of the things they did weren't very pleasant. But I'm hoping to see how the Western world is going to react to it and how they're going to come up with the best solution to deal with ISIS, to deal with the situation in the Middle East.
Khulod.
Yes.
Your final thoughts on ISIS and terrorism and the whole ickiness that this has become?
I would just encourage, you know, people to give others the benefit of the doubt, to not make wide assumptions, and to keep free thinking.
And Matt?
It's hard. There's so many thoughts that I have, and it's the biggest problem that I think I have is conflict in my mind, because I see the atrocities that go on and want to push for something to be done, unfortunately in a violent way, because that's the way that it's being dealt through war. But you know, I also want to find some kind of peaceful solution, whether that exists or whether it doesn't. I think right now for me, I'm just waiting to see how it all unfolds, and hopefully less bloodshed before that happens.
I think it's one of the conflicts you always get with this, and I imagine to a certain degree parents get it with their children as they kind of grow up, and that's a horrible analogy, but let me finish it. With as much as you feel like you need to step in and stop the pain, knowing that doing so will only prolong it means the wise thing seems to be to take a step back. That in the long arc of history, this is not a unique thing, and that these things have come and gone. And it would be great if we as a society had evolved to the point where we could intervene in a constructive way. But I think the interventions in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria have basically shown that we're not there yet. And that as horrific as it may be, containment may be the best policy and maybe the only policy as that is. On that note, and perhaps, well, again, it's a depressing topic, so we'll end it on a depressing note. We'll be right back after this break.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, Canada. This is our top news stories of 2015 host edition. We just finished with ISIS and terrorism. Let's return to our second topic, the federal election of 2015. Moving on to my last topic of the year, and seeing as I spent so much time during the year talking about this topic, it seems the election of 2015 is a sort of have-to-have of the big news stories of 2015. And I have a few sort of takes on it. I mean, one, and again, if you follow the show, the lead-up, the stakes in this election, I think, were huge. I think if we had one more sort of Harper presidency, well, sure, why not, Harper government, that, how shall we say, it would have been sort of a coup d'etat. I don't think we would have had another fair election after that. The tools were put in place for, again, a severe limitation, if not destruction, of democracy as we know it. And all that now seems sort of like fear-mongering, and I'm glad, because I'd much rather have been wrong about it than right about it. I mean, one of the spectacular things that seems to have happened was the, quote, failure of the Unfair Elections Act. Again, something we talked about, where Harper did sort of stack the deck in his favor. I think one of the things that he didn't see coming up, and again, when you live in bubbles, you don't see needles that may come to pop them, was the, I mean, visceral popular hatred that Harper seems to have instilled. Starting off with that aspect of it, do you guys think that I was nuts thinking that this would be the last fair election that we might have? And what was the root of the groundswelling, you know, the anyone but Harper, which I've never heard of before in Canadian politics, but it seemed to come out from nowhere. I remember being stunned outside of my local Safeway, people with petitions saying, hey, how can we coordinate our activities to ensure Harper doesn't get elected? I've seen lots of times of people saying, hey, please vote for my favorite politician, and here are the reasons why, but not this, again, hatred seems to be the only word that comes to mind. Who wants to start off on this one?
Don, I think the campaign you were looking for, by the way, was the Vote Now campaign, and I actually would have signed up personally, but luckily the riding that I've been in has been Liberal for a very long time, so there was no threat of a continuation of Harper in my riding, so... not saying, you know, I'm not showing who I was going to vote for or who I did, but it just, conservatives are not getting into my riding. I think Harper had a talent for the lack of a better term, pissing off many, many people. And that comes to a lot of different aspects, but I think right now so many people are much wiser to the need for environmentalism, and the conservative government did literally everything they could to make it worse. I think what they did tying our economy to, you know, a resource economy also angered a lot of people as well. But he did a lot of different things that a lot of different acts that just made our country worse. And that actually came up in the Paris talks. There was an interview with Elizabeth Bain when she came to tears after at the end of the talks, where she was hugged by some of the other representatives and saying, "Well, Canada's back. You know, it's so nice having good representation again." All this kind of stuff. But not only did he anger everyone in Canada, or not everyone, obviously, but so many people in Canada, but across the world, with how conservative we've been. And that's very unlike the Canada that we feel that we live in. I think that's kind of where some of it comes from.
I think I know where Goulet stands in this, and I'm kind of curious, Nicholas, are you one of them or are you one of us?
I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to talk about this since I work for the election this year. Personally, I'm not a big fan of Stephen Harper, just because of what he's done, especially in the science and technology part of the country. You know, I believe he removed the science and technology advisor role in Harper government. So I wasn't a big fan of Stephen Harper, but the interesting part of him being hated by so many people, I think it has, like, social media has played a very important role in this, especially for those who don't know too much about Stephen Harper and whatever he's done. Since our country has not been doing so well in the past, and in the last couple of years, I've always been Stephen Harper, and people just blame all the fault on Stephen Harper, and it's time to have another prime minister in Canada. I think that's one reason why he's hated so much by so many people in Canada.
I think it can play a bit into that idea that, you know, he's been there for too long. But I think when one of his own ads contravened his own law, when he was playing basically the ISIS theme song in the background of one of the conservative ads, that I think was sort of the road too far. Goulet, this was like the longest election we've had in, well, modern history for sure, and almost the entire history of the nation. Do you think that played into, you know, it basically gave the other parties time to milk the hatred people were feeling for Harper? Do you think that played into it?
I think that definitely does. But Harper's committed, you know, a lot of acts that have quite frankly pissed people off. So he was his own worst enemy. I guess he wasn't very exposed to the way the public was feeling, or made any type of attempt to deal with that. So, yeah, I think having such a long election definitely played a part and gave the other parties an opportunity to exploit people's hatred of Harper.
I know one of the things that the extended election period did was basically feck over the NDP. I mean, the NDP came into the election with the hands-down winner, if at least for a minority, if not a majority, government. And I think one of the spectacular things that came out of this election was the failure of the NDP. I mean, this was the NDP's election to lose, and, well, they lost it. They were trying to play the safe game. You know, one of the famous things that came out was their pledge to balance the budget, which is antithetical to an NDP sort of economic stance. I mean, at least under the current conditions. And I think that played a lot into it. Matt, do you have any thoughts about how the NDP just imploded in this election?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it also does come down to Trudeau's personality. I think he really thrived off of a long campaign just because people really started to like him. And I think that's what happened is, you're right, it was a campaign for them to lose, but at the same time, it was the campaign for the Liberals to lose, I feel like, as well. Because,
well, I'm gonna interrupt you just for a second, because this was plays on another thing. Because another aspect I wanted to bring up on this, and I think you're going to hit on it, is the Justin miracle, right? Mm-hmm. That the Liberals were seen to go be third place, but the fact that Justin positioned the Liberals to the left of the NDP was one of the whether he did it on purpose, but it was a genius move and allowed him to capture the anti-Harper campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. McClair actually came off a little bit, I don't want to say conservative, but he just came off. Yeah, he didn't seem like he was going to make, I want to say rash acts, but like he didn't seem like he would make the jumps that I think a lot of us felt were needed, if you know what I mean. Like, the Liberals and Trudeau promised a great many things that, as you mentioned, were very left. And as, again, you mentioned, the NDPs did no such thing. I think what they saw was, okay, well, conservatives are so popular, and maybe that's what Canada wants, so maybe let's try and give that to them. And I don't think Mulcair's attitude, or he didn't have the boisterism that, he didn't have the boisterous attitude that Trudeau had.
He definitely had a lot of charisma and definitely seemed like an attractive candidate to a lot of the people. It was funny watching the debate as well, how they mentioned his father, and he just sounded like he took a lot of opportunity to, you know, I don't want to say exploit, but, you know, take advantage of, you know, the people's hatred of Harper.
I think one of the things that came out of this, I mean, Justin came into the election and out of the election with a lot of high hopes. How do you think he sort of lived up to the promises so far, early days, that he made in the campaign?
I think it's still too early to tell at this moment. But as some of us will know, that there's a checklist for whatever Justin Trudeau has promised during campaign period. And so for everything he's done so far, we'll put a check on it to see if he, you know, fulfilled his promise. But yeah, I think he just started, you know, he's still young. There's still a long way to go. I'm excited to see what he has to offer.
Yeah, so if I may, the Trudeau meter, which I actually have up right now, states that there have been 214 promises made, 25 of which are in progress currently, 12 of which have been achieved, and 3 have been broken. I think one of them is the actual Syrian refugees. He promised 25,000 before the end of 2015, which obviously did not happen. I forget which the other ones were.
Apparently it's the airstrikes in Syria.
Yeah, but it's kind of forgivable. I think that one, to a degree, by some, with the attacks on Paris. I think for democracy's standpoint, like in terms of being favorable relations, he had to keep that up. I think pulling out in a time of this kind of political craziness with ISIS attacking Paris, I think he had to keep that up.
The third one was basically increasing the taxes on the rich while cutting the taxes on the middle and lower incomes. Although, yeah, because they haven't actually done a budget yet, I think that's a little early days on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree.
So I would say that of the things that I'm looking forward to, there are probably two biggies that I think he needs to do. And I will say this is at least a mediocre, if not successful, campaign. One is the legalization of pot. I think that's long overdue in this nation. It's something that we've already done here in BC. And if he can actually pull that off, because the American pressure for him not to do it is going to be huge. But the whole war on drugs, I think it's been proven many times over, and I've done a couple of shows on it, has been a complete failure. And we need to get away from the criminalization of drugs and treat it more as a health issue, at least in the worst case scenarios. The second thing, and this I'm all Twitter about, is election reform. And Justin Trudeau promised to make some form of proportional representation the norm for the next election. And how he will do it, how he will undo the damage done by the Unfair Election Act, I think will be something that I will judge him the most on. Nicholas, what are you thinking as one of the biggest things you want to see from Justin as we sort of round out this topic?
Once again, one of my favorite topic would be the Northern Gateway pipelines, as he's currently working on. I'm excited to see what he'll do with it.
Gulit?
You know, the legalization of marijuana is definitely coming. No, I'm kidding. I would probably say,
I mean, it's okay if you're not. I mean, if you're sitting in a smoky room right now, again, we won't judge you.
That's a good question.
But let me put it to you in a different way. What are you looking forward to coming out of the government in the next year? What's important to you?
I think you just said marijuana, right? A little bit of Bob Marley coming through.
I think I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, then Matt, what's the big things you're hoping from a Justin government?
His investment in green infrastructure. I've been looking through the list as you guys have been chatting, so I haven't been listening to you guys. And the one that popped out to me is $6 billion invested over 4 years.
And on that note, the fact that the NDP government in Alberta has just announced a huge thing about green energy for Alberta, Alberta being a very sunny province. It seems very natural transformation to go from an oil economy to a green economy, and Alberta has both resources in abundance. I'm going to close off with one last topic, which is, it seems once again the pollsters didn't know what the heck was going on, and that, you know, Justin's majority win basically took everyone blindsided, or almost everyone. Do you think, Gulit, what do you think? Can we ever trust pollsters again? Is this the end of polling as we know it?
I think it'll definitely keep going, but this will probably make us more skeptical and not rush our judgments towards voting.
Well, this has been, like I say, they got it wrong in the federal election. They got it wrong in the provincial election here in BC. They've got it wrong in more than one election. Nicholas, do you think that science will ever be able to quantify the Canadian electorate?
What do you mean by science?
Like polling, will it ever work?
Polling, as in people who call up people and say, hey, who are you going to vote for? And then actually be able to massage those numbers in such a way as that they actually mean something. Because it seems whatever they're doing now ain't working. So, Nicholas, with all the results that all the pollsters are getting wrong, can science figure out who's going to vote for who anymore? Or is this the end of polling as we know it?
I think polling can only give you a rough estimation about how people feel about the candidates. So polling is never accurate. It's not meant to be 100% accurate. You know, that's the difference between polling and election, actual election. There might be different ways to do the polling to make it more accurate, give it a better result for the candidates to work on in terms of campaign strategies. But I think polling at this stage is still necessary. They definitely need some, you know, new form of polling.
I would say that they're not even getting even close as far as that goes. In fact, I was listening to the BBC the other day, and they were commenting that the pollsters on their election, again, got it completely wrong on what they were doing. But surprisingly, one of the government agencies who apparently was doing some other sort of long-term studies got it right. And the big difference between them and the pollsters is the pollsters will go out and they will phone everyone on Thursday, and that's their result. If you answered the phone, they recorded you. If you didn't answer the phone, such c'est la vie. Whereas this other group were going out and they would call you up, and if you didn't answer, they would call you back the next day or the day after, or they'd go and they'd knock on your door. So they didn't get a snapshot so much as a long-term sort of view, but in their persistence, they seem to have got a much more accurate representation of what happened. So Matt, to close up this topic forever and for good, what are your thoughts on the idea of polling, and should we keep doing it? Does it matter? What are your thoughts?
Polling needs to evolve because of how our lives have evolved. I mean, how many people are actually at home, and especially the youth. And I think the Liberals got a lot of youth voters, I think, because of how many people turned out. I think, you know, 3 million more people turned out this time, or more, 4 million. But either way, I think a lot of it had to do with new voters and youth coming out and voting for Harper. Youth voting for Trudeau. And I think if somehow pollers were able to access, you know, cell phones and things like that, send a text message to who you're voting for, that would work out a lot better for them. So I think if there's an evolution, then I think there would be a lot better in terms of polling. But I don't think it should ever stop. I think it's a good way just to keep track. And also, I mean, what's the news going to talk about otherwise coming up to the vote?
Exactly. They might actually be worried about the issues as opposed to who's winning.
Who's going
to
win?
So on that note, we're going to call this show to an end. We will return next week, where we will hear the guest version of the Year in Review, where we'll find out what Nicholas, Gulid, and Matt think were the biggest stories of the year. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on. Nicholas, say goodbye.
Bye, guys. Keep on thinking. The world is a wonderful place.
Gulid?
Take care, folks. And remember, different skins, but all the same within.
And Matt?
Good night, folks. Don't forget to be awesome.
We're going to end with a clip from Test Tube News, where they ask the question, does the U.S. create terrorism? Let's listen in. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
In a recent Vice News interview, President Barack Obama blamed the existence of ISIS on the United States' invasion of Iraq in 2003. Yet former President George W. Bush claimed that terrorist groups around the world hate us for our freedom. So we want to know, does the U.S. create terrorists? Well, when comparing the 10-year periods before and after the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the Global Terrorism Database reports that roughly 21,000 terrorist incidents occurred between 1993 and 2003. In the years following the invasion, that number more than doubled. So why are the numbers increasing? Some conservative sources have blamed a weak foreign policy and political infighting for this massive increase. However, one political scientist has attributed 95% of suicide attacks in recent years to foreign occupation. And a 2004 government study concluded that the invasion has, quote, paradoxically elevated the stature of and support for radical Islamists. A former CIA interrogator wrote that the number one recruitment tool used by terrorist groups was knowledge of U.S. torture at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. A government report supports the accusation that torture policies damaged the accuracy of any intelligence collected and strengthened the hand of our enemies. Additionally, there is evidence that drone strikes have also led to an increase in anti-American radicalism. As it turns out, this isn't a new phenomenon. Back in the 1950s, the CIA coined the term blowback to describe the unintended consequences of overthrowing a Middle Eastern regime. Today, numerous studies and comments from several politicians have supported the idea that the U.S.-led intervention in the Middle East is the primary motivation for anti-American terrorism.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars, a still more glorious
Year of the Monkey at the largest Lunar New Year event in UBC history. The UBC Centennial Lunar New Year Festival